Now let us see if you can use from the topics to get an answer. I have brought here for the benefit of Mr. Plant and more directly of Mr. Reind and his colleagues. And we shall begin here in Hannes Born. Let me also first find it in my pocket. Yes. In the topic 101A25, what is it?
After the above remarks, the next point is to explain for how many and for what purposes this treatise was useful.
This treatise has the treatise of dialectics. Yes.
They are three in number: mental training, conversation, and the philosophic sciences.
Philosophic science means includes Feuerstein what we now call natural science.
That it is useful for mental training is obvious in the face of it. For if we have a method, we shall be able more easily to argue about the subject proposed. It is useful for conversation because, having enumerated the opinions of the majority, we shall be dealing with people on the basis of their own opinions.
It's not necessarily the majority, the opinions of the many. That is not quite the same as the majority. Hence the point of view. In other words, what is it then? Can you read the sentence again?
It is useful for conversation because, having enumerated the opinions of the many, we shall be dealing with people on the basis of their own opinion, not of those above it, changing the course of any argument which they appear to us to be using wrongly.
If you take out one part of the next one, that's good. Every argument ad hominem is a dialectical argument. Now, what is an argument ad hominem? Some of you will know that. What is an argument ad hominem?
Against
an individual rather than against the topic. Yeah, but that is not precise enough. The premise from which you start is granted by the cause of the formulated conversation. You argue from these premises, and it is irrelevant for this argument whether these premises are true or not, but they are insufficient, however, for the future. Yes, he grants the sentence. This is what he grants you the premise. And then you draw inferences from it. And if the inferences are destructive of his position, then he is refuted. To that extent, the argument can be very valuable. But it is not, of course, an argument, a scientific argument proper, because it doesn't start from premises which are true. This is one, and they are
usually, or most appropriately, to dialectic. For, being of the nature of an investigation, it lies along the path to the principle of all methods of inquiry.
Yes, now let us try to understand that. The scientific syllogism is the one which starts from two premises, without any reference or authority. But how do you arrive at the true premise? More radically stated, how do you arrive at the highest premise of the science? You cannot possibly derive them from something higher than the original first principle. You can arrive them only by ascending from what is generally accepted. Not that what generally, that what is generally accepted is simply true, but it's the only starting point which you have. The argument leading up from generally accepted truths on the subject to the true principle is also dialectic. And therefore, the dialectic in a civilian sense is very, at this fundamental ambiguity. That in one sense, take the enterprise as a whole, it is lower than time. Not time, not, it doesn't make use of of scientific theology, but in other sense it is higher than that, because it is a way to arrive at the highest principle. This ambiguity is essential to the rationalistic sense. One can also say what also means by dialectics is not identical, but has much in common what in the Middle Ages became the art of disputation. The art of disputation is also one which argues on the basis of what the other the disputant admits, and therefore the famous negative principle, who cannot dispute against him who denies the principle. We will find already in the beginning of the rhetoric some references to the art of dialectics, because according to Aristotle, dialectics and rhetoric are closely akin, and one cannot understand rhetoric properly if one does not consider the characteristics of dialectics. We could read a few more passages to give some information. At first, I would like to know how far Mr. Lewis. Yes, how can you? If scientific, that superficial is basic, if all science starts from the movement, then there must be something else that is realized. That is clear. But that is too general to be helpful, but only provisional. Now, then let us look at political things, at political matters. How do we proceed, even today? Anybody believes that. Where do we begin? According to the now accepted methodology. I'm not speaking now about what a man does who studies elections in Wisconsin last time, because this is not necessary. The need of this kind of thing, but the whole enterprise. The whole enterprise. Where do we start?
The average man?
No, in political science. We can also perhaps consider the average man there. Yeah, but still, if someone makes studies about the electoral process, sure, you have to know the general framework in which elections take place. But then, these are not just the questions which the Constitution doesn't supply to you, the questions which the student of election writes, so called us. The mere signs of the Constitution about the parties would be simplified, and we have to go beyond the Constitution. Now, what is the ordinary rule for this one? If we infer from definitions, how do we define definitions? What is the meaning of definitions? Now, according to one view, definitions are, which is now in power, definitions are fundamentally arbitrary. But the only thing is you must never use the term later on in your reasoning, except in the sense in which you define it. There is a book by Raphael Kaplan, I forgot now the title, which supplies such definitions. About 10 years ago. We supplied such definitions. But where do you, how do we arrive at such definitions? How do we arrive at it? Must we not primarily start from usage? In other words, that the definition of party must not be made in such a way sympathy with the mission of the other father, approves of housing. I mean, so that it would be, everyone would be reminded that there is a roof of houses. And in fact, you say that it is your father, it would be a bit absurd. So you start, in fact, from usage. And, good. But usage is, of course, covered and troubled by a certain ambiguity. When you use a various kind. And you think only of such a key word to not to go into any detail. The people who say in some matter of faith has this power, you must have heard that. Now, what is that? What is power? I mean, election power is also a kind of power. Obviously, that's not what the political plan is concerned with. What is that? I mean, how do we go from here after we have said the word power? I mean, how do we go from here? If we want to be, know what we do and also accept. Electric power? Why do you exclude electric power? And I think one would also say, in addition to electric power, there are also kinds of power among human beings, like that of, let me say, of a loan shark over his debtor. Definitely a form of the power of a human being over a human being. We also would not think particularly of that, I think. Or of the power which a bully in a schoolyard or maybe even elsewhere has over others. We somehow we have in mind political power. Yeah, political power. And that all power which men have over men is political. Good. But then what is political within this question? How do we go from here? We could not possibly begin to speak clearly about political matters without knowing what political is. Well, since we are in great trouble, as I suspect, not only Mr. Vygotsky, how did Aristotle perceive it?
You see,
I
am looking at first small relationships that which
but I would say it much more simply and stupidly as follows. He started from the fact that political is an adjective derived from the noun polis, which he translated by the city. And then he said, I can't answer the question what political is, but I don't know what the city is. Because political must be something which belongs to the city in one way, various ways of belonging, in one way or the other. Now, you see here, this draws some line on our difficulties. We still use the adjective. As a matter of course, I mean, and these people who say they can think of the Department of Government and not the Department of Political Science, and this thought that difficulty is not enough. I think it's even worse than the Department of Political Science or Politics or Civics. For what reason? Why can one not replace political by government? Replace it. as our politics says, very much to do with God and perhaps God is a core of politics. But why can one not live it? Is there some simple reflection? Yes.
Governments are a restriction of
political. In what sense?
In the sense that the government usually pertains to a legislative executive relationship, whereas political still gives. Is that the mind wandering? The other question is what makes up the civic relationship?
Yeah. Then in other words, everything leading to Simon could say for some elections are related because they are the form which the executive and the legislative are born. It belongs to government. But still what you say present points in the right direction. And let me take the simplest example. I think everyone would admit that a war is a political phenomenon. Can it be called a relation between governments? Is it sufficient for the striving of war? No, I think it wouldn't work. I mean, in other words, the declaration of war and the breaking off of diplomatic relations and so on and so on is simply not sufficient. The war is between the two nations or more nations and so on. So government is not, while it is a core, maybe the core of politics, it is not the whole. So now this kind of reflections which we make, which we are very focused on very first steps, are the ones which are in a way pre-scientific. We start from what everyone who is a sound mind would admit. And then we go on until we reach something where we have to think this is now the core of the issue, and here we concentrate. And then we raise the question, then we must not raise the question, how is if we cannot avoid raising the question, since we do not have no longer any polygamy. What is the present day equivalent of the polygamy to find our way, you know, so otherwise the world is. Would truly be inapplicable. Clearly, there is some kinship between what we talk about, when it's been appointed, and what others talk about. But the core, the polis, is no longer here. There must be some equivalent of it, and we would have to discover it, and then we could go on from here. These kind of reflections are pre-scientific, but obviously not rhetorical. Obviously not, there is no appeal of emotions and what the thought. And that is what Aristotle means by dialectic, by a certain part of dialectic. And this is in agreement with the Platonic procedure and the dialogues. Only in the Platonic dialogues this is almost always linked up in other kind of dialectic, which I do not now go in order not to confuse. Yes. Now, I wonder whether there is someone here who would defend the thesis, regardless of whether he believes in it or not, whether it is possible to do away entirely with the need for rhetoric in particular, because otherwise we have no access to Aristotle's rhetoric. Whether it would not be possible, not now of course, that everyone would admit, but in a better future, to have a society in which rhetoric as rhetoric is wholly superfluous, in which all arguments would be of scientific or technical, you know, this notion is somehow in the world, and the expectation is in the world. We must face it. Yes. Mr. Rotella.
Now, what I'm concerned about is the responsibility of the school and point in that direction, direction through science and proper education is not the problem.
job by education?
Using facts.
I think that is, but not only that. I mean, after all, did you ever read Human Nature and Human? This is not too narrow view of what Dewey means. Dewey is not a present-day positivist. Dewey has an ethics. I mean, this ethics may not be satisfactory, but it is an ethical teaching, whereas what you have today is strictly and merely a theory about the logical status of ethical conversations, but no ethical teaching, you know, no teaching of what is a good life. Dewey has a teaching about a good life. And the present-day view is that there can be only a teaching about the various conceptions of a good life, or how to talk about a good life, but not about the good life itself. Dewey has such a teaching. And therefore, it escapes from what they should say.
I'm not saying, Mr. Gottman, to sell modern-day inner science much too short.
That is what I mean. That is what I
don't appreciate it, because you want modern-day inner science to know now what modern-day natural science knows after only 500 years of work.
Yeah, this is exactly the argument against me.
I don't want that. Yeah. But if you read yourself, I'm sure you have to realize the progress of men from noble savages to when truly think they're all the police. The only police will force you in the normal way of getting things done. Look how far we've progressed today. Where people are at least abject criminals, or at least on some little technicality of being pushed by a police officer or something like that. Look how far we've come today in many lots of 10 years. Bastard. We'll get
a point
of enlightenment from Congress,
we'll
be the way of the world.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's, I know it is true. But in such a situation, rhetoric would have no place whatever.
And it doesn't contribute to the devil that some forms of psychoanalysis are not rhetoric, it's client-centered therapy, where you just say something to sit around and nod understandingly. And the criminal talks out all his difficulties. And this is not rhetoric, but science. And
not what the criminal does, or what the patient
does. Well, he just talks.
Yeah, but
and comes to remember
everything,
like a when platonic soul, he remembers his earliest childhood and is so liberated from his fears and goes and sins no more.
Yes.
I'm failing that, we give him tranquilizers.
But still, whatever it may be true, in no way one man would say that the man of the codes is a scientist. He's only an object of science, and the psychoanalysis true scientist, people have this collateral way of getting data which were hitherto unknown, and on the basis of the knowledge of this data, he can make a proper diagnosis and therefore develop a proper therapy. And so this would only confirm it. I mean, in other words, this is what you say. New provinces of life have been discovered and the process of being discovered, and we cannot know. There may be some other individuals like Troy in the future, who, not exactly in this sphere, but in other spheres, make such radical discoveries, and no one can predict better than it may not be possible there will no longer be any need for rhetoric. And all speech will be scientific speech. Now, I believe you imply this poor fellow who has his troubles is wholly unable to speak scientifically about his troubles. He's only an object of science.
He isn't, in fact, brought to scientific speech. Instead of being given a pep talk by the social worker, they spend, which would be persuasive, he is brought through unemotional speech to understand his own emotions, dispassionate.
Yes. do you know what I think some scientists know? That the key element of this thought, to the core of this thought, namely exaltation or any other rhetorical devices, are much less good for liberating us from the power of our passions than the scientific analysis of our passions. For example, if someone is in the grip of a passion, and then the traditional world is saying, remember that you are a human being. Think of the dignity of man. What a disgraceful thing to be a slave of your age. And then your father considers how worthless the object is about which you are so enraged. And then people say, no, simply analyze it. What are the efficient causes of your rage now? And by making this process of the genesis of your rage fully conscious and have a clear and distinct idea of your rage instead of the confused idea, then really, it was Spinoza. I mean, some people know this today, that this is, this overall idea is much older than Freud. Sure, it was overall, and there is no place to speak of in Spinoza for rhetoric. He never wrote rhetoric. And I do not remember offhand any passage where he affirms its necessity. Yes, surely he must. But I wish only that this is clear to us, that there is, on the basis of the now prevailing notions, it is hard to see how rhetoric can at all be legitimate. There is only one difficulty, and that is, as is also admitted by social science today, the value judgments are ultimately not be established by scientific reasoning.
When the time comes when we're putting little things in the brain and using what occurs, they can make all men do what they want to do.
Yeah, sure, but I have no doubt. It is perfectly possible that there will be brain washing compared with which what he has seen in child's brain. But the question is, these fellows who brainwash you, super brainwash you, will do this for some value? Yeah. Whatever they may be. These values, they cannot establish rationally. Or else social science would have to undergo a radical reform. I mean, a much greater than what Freud and such people achieved. So that the value judgment, the highest value judgment, are again capable of being rationally validated. So you see that, I believe, therefore, the ordinary view that not only psychology and such science or sociology catch up with physics and chemistry, then we had got into trouble by the atomic bomb and similar things. And well, the trouble exists only because psychology has not yet caught up with physics and chemistry. Yes? But it's not impossible. Because the same limitation of physics and chemistry, that they cannot say how to use the power supplied by physics and chemistry, applies, of course, also to psychology and sociology. I mean, these famous conclusions of social science regarding discrimination and integration, they are, of course, not simply scientific, but based on certain value premises, these things in themselves, which they cannot validate. Yeah. I mean, if someone would simply say, a healthy society, in my opinion, a society which has vigorous prejudices as social bonds, yeah, and then if something is proven to be based on a prejudice, it's not right to such a refuse. You see that? The very principle that the society should be rational cannot be established by reason, given the present view of the difference between factor and value of symbols. So this will be my reply to that.
Is your criticism of an impossibility of modern social science to rationally validate its value judgments?
That is his own assertion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is your criticism so clear against a man like Dewey, who is
no.
mentioned here?
It would be entirely different. Because Dewey does not Dewey antedates this fact value thing, which came to this country from Europe, and probably more via Max Weber than via anybody else, although Max Weber did not originate. And Dewey is pre-Weberian. I mean, to use another language, Dewey is pre-critical. Dewey's evidence doctrine is, in one respect, a modification of utilitarianism. But I think more clearly a modification of Einstein. The content is entirely different, but the form and structure reminds me of a good life is a virtuous life. And the virtuous life is defined by Einstein he makes a fundamental distinction between custom and impulse. Now, a custom is the inherited. We always had inherited and some things are regarded as proper and so on. And then this is, but on the basis of custom and an idea of the specific inheritance of a given society, there are always individual impulses which differ from the merely custom. What we would call the individuality of the individual. And now to take the side of custom against impulse is reactionary. To take the side of the impulse against custom, and the war is anarchist, destructive of all together. So you must strike a balance between custom and impulse. And this balance will differ for different individuals in different situations. This is very crudely the Dewey view. And there is, so reason, judgment is very important, striking the balance. And it is not very clear that this striking the balance is essentially the affair of science, although one could very well say that Dewey might admit that there are men of judgment and men lacking judgment. And the men lacking judgment must go then to some technician. For example, should they marry this girl? Yeah, and some people say that I think I am the best judge of whom I should marry. And others would feel have no faith in the judgment, then they go to a marriage counselor. And who would, on the basis of the results of science, about happy and unhappy marriage, hand down an advice? But the key point I made in Dewey's doctrine system is this. There is no prohibition in Dewey that there could be something like evil in it. The place of evil is rather taken by the vested interest, meaning the non-impulsive, the mere as a custom, the inherited. And this, I believe, is the serious effect. Aristotle took this into serious consideration, that there is evil, and therefore there is a need, there are kind of problems which cannot be solved by any judgment, by mere judgment alone, whether it is that of a counselor or oneself, but you simply have to put your foot down. And whether you have the willpower to do it or not, not much can be said about it, you know, and not much can be done about it.
My reflection on this was that if the assertion that was discussed is true, and that there is some, the tendency of a teaching like Dewey's to
would be to result in a way of necessity for rhetoric. If that is true, it's very interesting that it would be advanced by a man who would be considered a rhetorician of first class.
Yeah, no, I believe that even the greatest admirers of himself, who is, as far as I know, never said that he was a rhetorician of first class. He is a singularly ineffective writer. Every sort of human nature and conduct which deals with ethics. There is, if I remember well, not a single example. Not a single, now, you know, in matters of conduct, examples are absolutely necessary to carry and to reach evidence and verification. No, I think that Zulay never was regarded as a great stylist by anyone, and Stein and rhetoric has something.
We have to be aware of attributing the psychology as such, or psychiatry, or psychoanalysis, of the views that are prevalent among some practitioners in these fields. I had a conversation about a week ago with a very prominent psychiatrist. Went out of his way in the course of the conversation to deny any belief at all remotely approaching the assertion that psychoanalysis is omnipotent, and regarded as a rather perverse use of the methods and techniques of the field, to assume that we can do away with the notion of the criminal or do away with the need for reverence, coercion, and assert very strongly that psychoanalysis in which you a method that could work only within a certain set of assumptions and beliefs about what's good
and also certain institutions.
Yeah, and could not be useless to anybody. The mere fact that someone submits to that method of therapy is a sign of having accepted a whole host of institutions and attitudes without which the method just couldn't work.
No, the institution is most obvious, of course, that if somebody would try to set up shop in Moscow, he would find it impractical. So in other words, you must have negatively a kind of government which is willing to accept the basic premise of psychoanalysis, and which I believe which is not peculiar to psychoanalysis, which can be stated as follows, that the solution of the social problem of society is not the solution of the problem of the individual. Whereas Marxism asserts, and the Marxists would simply say, of course, there is no guarantee that if there is a reversal of communism, that there will be no unhappy love. But they would simply say that if a man or a woman takes unhappy love too seriously, then it is a sign that there is an imperfection. You know? And that will simply be. There was a thing which they showed about Siberia. I do not know whether you have seen it, but they presented this problem quite impressively. I mean, of how a communist would get rid of this kind of problem, simply reminding himself of his duty to the common society, and not merely private problems. They can be, So, surely, of course, I have no doubt, you know, but in Freud himself, there is this famous premise, which Freud was the opposite of an optimist regarding the future, as you know. And especially his principle that there is in man a death urge, which is someone, conversing with this kind of thing, told me has not been accepted by any of Freud's students. Now, this existence of such a deep self-destructive thing, which cannot be reduced to broken homes and any of this kind, it shows, of course, that Freud did not believe in the omnipotence of any technique. That's clear.
This
man was shocked in a hard life for people who were students of political science. He thought that the aim of political science would be reduction of the subject matter in psychology or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, but
you see, and then he should address
his shock or his complaint to the man who did it. And I know only one thing, that no one I believe has a greater significance with respect than Harold Lasswell. And I heard to my great surprise from my colleague writers that he agrees fundamentally with Lasswell, the author of the Lasswell in this respect, and he has made a study of Plonky's lines on a well-known subject, and he had some good news in his publication. And I said, I'm so surprised, why don't you tell it to Lasswell? Yeah, Lasswell being a very influential man. And he said, Lasswell does no longer have this belief in that belief in psychoanalysis, which he had, say, 20 or 30 years ago. So today, I believe, who is there in social science, especially in political science, who has this great belief in psychoanalysis? In his earlier period, that was shown, I think, very well by Robert Horowitz in his critical analysis of Lasswell. Lasswell's view amounted to this, that strictly speaking, the people who should rule society would be the psychoanalysts, because they are the only ones who can judge whether someone is sane and sober and balanced or not, you know? And this is, of course, incompatible with democracy. And there is a certain ultimate step with which Lasswell seems to explain, to say the least, that every citizen should become a psychoanalyst. See, otherwise you have psychoanalytocracy, not democracy. But if every citizen is a psychoanalyst, you have, of course, a synthesis of psychoanalysis and democracy. And I think that, of course, I believe no expert Lasswell has ever entertained that. But one must also consider not what is reasonable, psychoanalyst or for that matter, sociologist says, but also what is implied in the general style or trend of modern science as a whole, and that was quite well stated by you. This simple thing, we have science is for the sake of power. That science has increased man's power tremendously. I think it's an empirical fact, if there ever was one. And therefore, since sociology and psychology cannot possibly compete in success with physics and chemistry, one can argue that they started much later. Yeah? You know how long it took until laboratory psychology took the place of armchair psychology and the same only of all these developments. Therefore, it is only a matter of one or two centuries, or three centuries at most, when psychology and sociology have caught up. This is a perfectly legitimate way of reasoning, regardless of what the sane and sober individual sociologist or psychologist thinks. That remains. And the question is whether this reasoning by analogy is valid, and whether it is not undercut radically by the other consideration that the old notion, science for the sake of power, presupposes that the men who acquire that power, produce that power, have knowledge of the legitimate uses of power. When Francis Bacon and Descartes and such people spoke of this use of science, they were sure there is knowledge that health is good, a long life is good, and to thought. There is no question that there are, and this is not merely an arbitrary value judgment, it is known to us. And this, in the moment, however, when Rousseau, to whom so many of you referred, when Rousseau, more than anybody else, raised this question against his older social science, you older men, said the Cardinal Hobbes, you assume that there is an unchangeable human nature. And why is the means of satisfying the needs of that unchangeable nature very intricately? The needs do not change itself. Now, when Rousseau said there is no unchangeable human nature, then of course it was impossible to have any knowledge of the unchangeable needs of men, and the ultimate outcome of that societal distinction. That's the situation. So I believe the analogy is not good, but it has a great prima facie rhetorical power. So we will meet next time.